Hermione spent the long evening sitting by the chaplain, reciting her grievances against Father Roche to him. He was ignorant, he was clumsy, he had said the Confiteor before the Adjutorum, during the Mass last Sunday, and he was out there in that ice-cold church on his knees, Kivrin thought, while the chaplain warmed his hands at the fire and shook his head disapprovingly. The fire died down to glowing embers. Rosamond slid off Blowett's lap and ran back to the game. Garwin told the story of how he had killed 6 wolves, watching Eloise the whole time. The chaplain told a story about a dying woman who had made false confession. When the chaplain had touched her forehead with the holy oil, her skin had smoked and turned black before his eyes. Halfway through the chaplain's story, Garwin stood up, rubbed his hands over the fire, and went over to the beggar's bench. He sat down and pulled off his boot. After a minute, Eloise stood up and went over to him. Kivrin couldn't hear what she said to him, but he stood up, the boot still in his hand.
"The trial is once more delayed,"
Kivrin heard Garwin say.
"The judge who was to hear it is taken ill."
She couldn't hear Eloise's answer, but Garwin nodded and said,
"It is good news. The new judge is from Swindon, and less kindly disposed to King Edward."
But neither of them looked like it was good news. Eloise was nearly as white as she had been when Hermione told her she'd sent Garwin to Courcy. She twisted her heavy ring. Garwin sat down again, brushed the rushes from the bottom of his hose, and pulled the boot on, and then looked up again and said something. Eloise turned her head aside, and Kivrin couldn't see her expression for the shadows. But she could see Garwin's. And so could anyone else in the hall, Kivrin thought, and looked hastily around to see if the couple had been observed. Hermione was deep in complaint with the chaplain. But Sir Blowett's sister was watching, her mouth tight with disapproval. And so, on the opposite side of the fire, were Blowett and the other men. Kivrin had hoped she might have a chance to speak with Garwin tonight, but she obviously could not among all these watchful people. A bell rang, and Eloise started and looked toward the door.
"It is the devil's knell," the chaplain said quietly, and even the children stopped their games to listen. In some villages, the contempts had rung the bell once for each year since the birth of Christ. In most, it had only been tolled for the hour before midnight, and Kivrin doubted whether Roche or even the chaplain could count high enough to toll the years. But she began keeping count anyway. 3 servants came in, bearing logs and kindling, and replenished the fire. It flared up brightly, throwing huge, distorted shadows on the walls. Agnes jumped up and pointed, and one of Sir Blowett's nephews made a rabbit with his hands. Mr. Latimer told her that the contempts had read the future in the Yule log's shadows. She wondered what the future held for them. Lord Guillaume in trouble, and all of them in danger. The king had forfeited the lands and property of convicted criminals. They might be forced to live in France, or to accept charity from Sir Blowett and endure snubs from the steward's wife. Or Lord Guillaume might come home tonight with good news, and a falcon for Agnes, and they would all live happily ever after. Except Eloise. And Rosamond. What would happen to her? It's already happened, Kivrin thought wonderingly. The verdict is already in, and Lord Guillaume's come home and found out about Garwin and Eloise. Rosamond's already been handed over to Sir Blowett, and Agnes has grown up and married and died in childbirth, or of blood poisoning, or cholera, or pneumonia. They've all died, she thought, and couldn't make herself believe it. They've all been dead over 700 years.
Look!
Agnes shrieked.
Rosamond has no head!
She pointed to the distorted shadows the fire cast on the walls as it flared up. Rosamond's, oddly elongated, ended at the shoulders. One of the red-headed boys ran over to Agnes.
I have no head either,
he said, jumping on tiptoe to change the shadow's shape.
You have no head, Rosamond,
Agnes shouted happily.
You will die ere the year is out.
Say not such things, Eloise said, darting toward her. Everyone looked up.
Kivrin has a head, Agnes said. I have a head, but poor Rosamond has none.
Eloise caught hold of Agnes by both arms.
Those are but foolish games, she said. Say not such things.
The shadow,
Agnes said, looking like she was going to cry.
Sit you down by Lady Catherine and be still,
Eloise said. He brought her over to Kivrin and almost pushed her onto the bench.
You are grown too wild.
Agnes huddled next to Kivrin, trying to decide whether to cry or not. Kivrin had lost count, but she picked up where she had left off. 46. 47.
I want my bell,
Agnes said, climbing off the bench.
Nay,
we must sit quietly, Kivrin said. She took Agnes onto her lap.
Tell me of Christmas.
I can't, Agnes. I can't remember.
Do you remember naught that you can tell me?
I remember it all, Kivrin thought. The shops are full of ribbons, satin and mylar and velvet, red and gold and blue, brighter even than my woe-dyed cloak. And there's light everywhere and music, great Tom and Maudlin's bells and Christmas carols. She thought of the Carfax carillon trying to play It Came Upon the Midnight Clear, and the tired old piped-in carols in the shops along the high.
Those carols haven't even been written yet,
Kivrin thought, and felt a sudden wash of homesickness.
I would ring my bell,
Agnes said, struggling to get off Kivrin's lap.
Give it to me.
She held out her wrist.
I will tie it on if you will lie down a little on the bench beside me,
Kivrin said. She started to pucker up into a pout again.
Must I sleep?
No.
I will tell you a story, Kivrin said, untying the bell from her own wrist, where she had put it for safekeeping.
Once,
she said, and then stopped, wondering if Once Upon a Time dated as far back as 1320. And what sort of stories the contemps told their children. Stories about wolves and about witches whose skin turned black when they were given extreme unction.
There was once a maiden, she said,
tying the bell on Agnes's chubby wrist. The red ribbon had already begun to fray at the edges. It wouldn't tolerate many more knottings and unknottings. She bent over it.
A maiden who lived.
Is this the maiden?
A woman's voice said. Kivrin looked up. It was Blowett's sister, Ivalde, with Imani behind her. She stared at Kivrin, her mouth pinched with disapproval, and then shook her head.
Nay, this is not Ulurak's daughter, she said. That maid was short and dark.
Nor the Ferrer's ward,
Imani said.
She's dead,
Ivalde said.
Do you remember naught of who you are?
She asked Kivrin.
Nay, good lady,
Kivrin said, remembering too late that she was supposed to keep her eyes modestly on the floor.
She was struck upon the head, Agnes volunteered.
you remember your name and how to speak? Are you of good family?
I do not remember my family, good lady, Kivrin said, trying to keep her voice meek. Ivalda sniffed.
She sounds of the West. Have you sent to Bath for news?
Nay, Imani said.
My son's wife would wait on his arrival. You have heard naught from Oxenford?
Nay, but there is much illness there,
Ivaldi said. Rosamond came up.
Know you Lady Catherine's family, Lady Ivaldi?
She asked. Ivaldi turned her pinched look on her.
Nay. Where is the brooch my brother gave you?
Tis on my cloak, Rosamond stammered.
Do you not honor his gifts enough to wear them?
Go and fetch it, Lady Imani said. I would see this brooch.
Rosamond's chin went up, but she went over to the outer wall where the cloaks hung.
She shows as little eagerness for my brother's gifts as for his presents,
Ivaldi said.
She spoke not once to him at supper.
Rosamond came back, carrying her green cloak with the brooch pinned to it. She showed it wordlessly to Imani.
I would see it, Agnes said,
and Rosamond bent down to show her. The brooch had red stones set on a round gold ring and the pin in the center. It had no hinge, but had to be pulled up and stuck through the garment. Letters ran around the outside of the ring. Io, Juisen, Louis, Dami, Amo.
What does it say?
Agnes said, pointing to the letters ringing the gold circle.
I know not, Rosamond said, in a tone that clearly meant, and I don't care.
Ivalda's jaw tightened, and Kivrin said hastily, It says you are here in place of the friend I love, Agnes. And then realized sickly what she had done.
She looked up at Imani, but Imani didn't seem to have noticed anything.
Such words should be on your breast instead of hanging on a peg,
Imani said. She took the brooch and pinned it to the front of Rosamond's kirtle.
And you should be at my brother's side, as befits his betrothed,
Ivaldi said,
instead of playing childish games.
She extended her hand in the direction of the hearth, where Bluet was sitting, nearly asleep, and obviously the worse for all the trips outside. And Rosamond looked beseechingly at Kivrin.
Go and thank Sir Bluet for such a generous gift,
Imani said coldly. Rosamond handed Kivrin her cloak and started toward the hearth. Come, Agnes, Kivrin said. You must rest.
I would listen to the devils now, Agnes said. Lady Catherine,
Ivaldi said, and there was an odd emphasis on the word lady.
You told us you remembered naught, yet you read Lady Rosamond's brooch with ease. Can you read, then?
I can read, Kivrin thought, but fewer than a third of the contempts could, and even fewer of women. She glanced at Imani, who was looking at her the way she had the first morning she was here, fingering her clothes and examining her hands.
No,
Kivrin said, looking Ivaldi directly in the eye. I fear I cannot read even the Paternoster. Your brother told us what the words meant when he gave the brooch to Rosamond.
Nay, he did not,
Agnes said. You were looking at your bell, Kivrin said, thinking, Lady Ivaldi will never believe that. She'll ask him,
and he'll say he never spoke to me. But Ivaldi seemed satisfied.
I did not think such a one as she would be able to read, she said to Amani. She gave her her hand, and they walked over to Sir Bluett.
Kivrin sank down on the bench.
I would have my bell, Agnes said.
I will not tie it on unless you lie down.
Agnes crawled into her lap.
You must tell me the story first. Once there was a maiden.
Once there was a maiden, Kivrin said.
He looked at Amani and Ivaldi. They had sat down next to Sir Bluett and were talking to Rosamond. She said something, her chin up and her cheeks were red. Sir Bluett laughed, and his hand closed over the brooch, and then slid down over Rosamond's breast.
Once there was a maiden, Agnes said insistently,
who lived at the edge of a great forest, Kivrin said. Do not go into the forest alone, her father said.
But she would not heed him, Agnes said, yawning.
No, she wouldn't heed him. Her father loved her and cared only for her safety. But she wouldn't listen to him.
What was in the woods?
Agnes asked, nestling against Kivrin.
Kivrin pulled Rosamond's cloak up over her.
Cutthroats and thieves, she thought, and lecherous old men and their shrewish sisters, and illicit lovers, and husbands, and judges.
All sorts of dangerous things.
Wolves, Agnes said sleepily.
Yes, wolves. She looked at Hermione and Ivaldi. They had moved away from Sir Bluett and were watching her, whispering.
What happened to her?
Agnes said sleepily, her eyes already closing. Kivrin cradled her close.
I don't know, she murmured. I don't know.
Chapter 20 Agnes could not have been asleep more than 5 minutes before the bell stopped, and then began to ring again, more quickly, calling them to mass.
Father Roche begins too soon. It is not midnight yet,
Lady Hermione said, and it wasn't even out of her mouth before the other bells started. Witchlade and Burford and far away to the east, too far to be more than a breath of an echo, the bells of Oxford.
There are the Osney bells, and there's Carfax, Kivrin thought,
and wondered if they were ringing at home tonight too. Sir Bluett heaved himself to his feet, and then helped his sister up. One of their servants hurried in with their cloaks and a squirrel fur-lined mantle. The chattering girls pulled their cloaks from the pile and fastened them, still chattering. Lady Hermione shook Maisery, who'd fallen asleep on the beggar's bench, and told her to fetch her book of hours, and Maisery shuffled off to the loft ladder, yawning. Rosamond came over and reached with exaggerated carefulness for her cloak, which had slid off Agnes's shoulders. Agnes was dead to the world. Kivrin hesitated, hating to have to wake her up, but fairly sure even exhausted five-year-olds weren't accepted from this mass.
Agnes, she said softly.
You must needs carry her to the church, Rosamond said,
struggling with Sir Bluett's gold brooch. The steward's youngest boy came and stood in front of Kivrin with her white cloak, dragging it on the rushes.
Agnes, Kivrin said again,
and jostled her a little, amazed that the church bell hadn't waked her. It sounded louder and closer than it ever did for matins or vespers, its overtones nearly drowning out the other bells.
Agnes's eyes flew open.
You did not wake me,
she said sleepily to Rosamond, and then more loudly as she came awake.
You promised to wake me.
Get into your cloak, Kivrin said. We must go to church.
Kivrin, I would wear my bell.
You're wearing it, Kivrin said, trying to fasten Agnes's red cape without stabbing her in the neck with the pin of the clasp.
Nay, I have it not, Agnes said, searching her arm. I would wear my bell.
Here it is, Rosamond said, picking it up off the floor. It must have fallen from your wrist. But it is not meet to wear it now. This bell calls us to Mass. The Christmas bells come after.
I shall not ring it, Agnes said. I would only wear it.
Kivrin didn't believe that for a minute, but everyone else was ready. One of Sir Bluett's men was lighting the horn lanterns with a brand from the fire and handing them to the servants. She hastily tied the bell to Agnes's wrist and took the girls by the hand. Lady Eloise laid her hand on Sir Bluett's upheld one. Lady Hermione signaled to Kivrin to follow with the little girls, and the others fell in behind them solemnly, as if it were a procession. Lady Hermione was Sir Bluett's sister, and then the rest of Sir Bluett's entourage. Lady Eloise and Sir Bluett led the way out into the courtyard, through the gate, and onto the green. It had stopped snowing, and the stars had come out. The village lay silent under its covering of white. Frozen in time, Kivrin thought. The dilapidated buildings looked different. The staggering fences and filthy daubed huts softened and graced by the snow. The lanterns caught the crystalline facets of the snowflakes and made them sparkle. But it was the stars that took Kivrin's breath away. Hundreds of stars, thousands of stars, and all of them sparkling like jewels in the icy air.
It shines, Agnes said.
And Kivrin didn't know whether she was talking about the snow or the sky. The bell tolled evenly, calmly, its sound different again out in the frosty air. Not louder, but fuller and somehow clearer. Kivrin could hear all the other bells now and recognize them. Estcott and Whitney and Chirtle in tone, even though they sounded different too. She listened for the Swindon bell, which had rung all this time, but she couldn't hear it. She couldn't hear the Oxford bells either. She wondered if she had only imagined them.
You are ringing your bell, Agnes, Rosamond said. I am not, Agnes said. I'm only walking.
Look at the church, Kivrin said. Isn't it beautiful? It flamed like a beacon at the other end of the green, lit from inside and out, the stained glass windows throwing wavering ruby and sapphire lights on the snow. There were lights all around it, too, filling the churchyard all the way to the bell tower. Torches. She could smell their tarry smoke. More torches made their way in from the white fields, winding down from the hill behind the church. She thought suddenly of Oxford on Christmas Eve, the shops lit for last-minute shopping, and the windows of Brasenose shining yellow onto the quad, and the Christmas tree at Balliol lit with multicolored strings of laser lights.
I would that we had come to you for Yule, Lady Hermione said to Lady Evaldi. Then we had had a proper priest to say the masses. This place's priest can but barely say the Paternoster.
This place's priest just spent hours kneeling in an ice-cold church, Kivrin thought. Hours kneeling in hose that have holes in the knees. And now this place's priest is ringing a heavy bell that has had to be tolled for an hour and will shortly go through an elaborate ceremony that he has had to memorize because he cannot read.
It will be a poor sermon and a poor mass, I fear, Lady Hermione said.
Alas! There are many who do not love God in these days, Lady Evaldi said. But we must pray to God that he will set the world right and bring men again to virtue.
Kivrin doubted if that answer was what Lady Imani wanted to hear.
I have sent to the Bishop of Bath to send us a chaplain, Imani said, but he has not yet come.
My brother says there is much trouble in Bath, Evaldi said.
They were almost to the churchyard. Kivrin could make out faces now, lit by the smoky torches, and by little oil crosettes some of the women were carrying. Their faces, reddened and lit from below, looked faintly sinister. Mr. Dunworthy would think they were an angry mob, Kivrin thought, gathered to burn some poor martyr at the stake.
It's the light, she thought. Everyone looks like a cutthroat by torchlight. No wonder they invented electricity.
They came into the churchyard. Kivrin recognized some of the people near the church doors, the boy with the scurvy who had run from her. Two of the young girls who'd helped with the Christmas baking. Cobb. The steward's wife was wearing a cloak with an ermine collar and carrying a metal lantern with four tiny panes of real glass. She was talking animatedly to the woman with the scrofulous scars who had helped put up the holly. They were all talking and moving around to keep warm, and one man with a black beard was laughing so hard his torch swept dangerously close to the steward's wife's wimple. Church officials had eventually had to do away with the midnight mass because of all the drinking and carousing, Kivrin remembered, and some of these parishioners definitely looked like they had spent the evening breaking fast. The steward was talking animatedly to a rough-looking man Rosamond pointed out as Maisry's father. Both their faces were bright red from the cold, or the torchlight, or the liquor, or all three, but they seemed gay rather than dangerous. The steward kept punctuating what he was saying with hard, thunking claps on Maisry's father's shoulder. And every time he did it, the father laughed, a happy, helpless giggle that made Kivrin think he was much brighter than she had supposed. The steward's wife grabbed for her husband's sleeve, and he shook her off. But as soon as Lady Eloise and Sir Blowett came through the lich gate, he and Maisra's father fell back promptly to make a clear path into the church. So did all the others, falling silent as the entourage passed through the churchyard and in the heavy doors. And then beginning to talk again, but more quietly, as they came into the church behind them. Sir Blowett unbuckled his sword and handed it to a servant, and he and Lady Eloise knelt and genuflected as soon as they were in the door. They walked almost to the rude screen together and knelt again. Kivrin and the little girls followed. When Agnes crossed herself, her bell jangled hollowly in the church. I'll have to take it off of her, Kivrin thought, and wondered if she should step out of the procession now and take Agnes off to the side by Lady Imani's husband's tomb and undo it. But Lady Imani was waiting impatiently at the door with Sir Blowett's sister. She led the girls to the front. Sir Blowett had already lumbered to his feet again. Eloise stayed on her knees a little longer and then stood, and Sir Blowett escorted her to the north side of the church, bowed slightly, and walked over to take his place on the men's side. Kivrin knelt with the little girls, praying Agnes wouldn't make too much noise when she crossed herself again. She didn't, but when Agnes got to her feet, she snagged her foot in the hem of her robe and caught herself with a clanging almost as loud as the bell still tolling outside. Lady Imani was, of course, right behind them. She glared at Kivrin. Kivrin took the girls to stand beside Eloise. Lady Imani knelt, but Lady Evaldi made only an obeisance. As soon as Imani rose, a servant hurried forward with a dark velvet-covered prie-dieu and laid it on the floor next to Rosamond for Lady Evaldi to kneel on. Another servant had laid one in front of Sir Blowett on the men's side,
and was helping him get down on his knees on it. He puffed and clung to the servant's arm as he lowered his bulk, and his face got very red.
Kivrin looked at Lady Evolda's prie-dieu longingly, thinking of the plastic kneeling pads that hung on the backs of the chairs in St. Mary's. She had never realized until now what a blessing they were. What a blessing the hard wooden chairs were either, until they stood again, and she thought about how they would have to remain standing through the whole service. The floor was cold. The church was cold, in spite of all the lights. They were mostly cressets, set along the walls and in front of a holly-banked statue of St. Catherine, though there was a tall, thin, yellowish candle set in the greenery of each of the windows. But the effect was probably not what Father Roche had intended. The bright flames only made the colored panes of glass darker, almost black. More of the yellowish candles were in the silver candelabra on either side of the altar, and holly was heaped in front of them and along the top of the rude screen, and Father Roche had set Lady Hermione's beeswax candles in among the sharp, shiny leaves. He had done a job of decorating the church that should please even Lady Hermione, Kivrin thought, and glanced at her. She was holding her reliquary between her folded hands, but her eyes were open, and she was staring at the top of the rude screen. Her mouth was tight with disapproval, and Kivrin supposed she hadn't wanted the candles there, but it was the perfect place for them. They illuminated the crucifix and the Last Judgment, and lit nearly the whole nave. They made the whole church seem different, homier, more familiar, like St. Mary's on Christmas Eve. Dunworthy had taken her to the ecumenical service last Christmas. She had planned to go to midnight mass at the Holy Reform to hear it said in Latin, but there hadn't been a midnight mass. The priest had been asked to read the gospel for the ecumenical service, so he had moved the mass to 4 in the afternoon. Agnes was fiddling with her bell again. Lady Hermione turned and glared at her across her piously folded hands, and Rosamond leaned across Kivrin and shushed her. "You mustn't ring your bell until the mass is over," Kivrin whispered, bending close to Agnes so no one else could hear her. "I rang it not," Agnes whispered back in a voice that could be heard all over the church. "The ribbon binds too tight. Do you?" Kivrin couldn't see any such thing. In fact, if she had taken the time to tie it tighter, it wouldn't be ringing at every movement. But there was no way she was going to argue with an overtired child when the mass was going to begin any minute. She reached for the knot. Agnes must have been trying to pull the bell off over her wrist. The already fraying ribbon had tightened into a solid little knot. Kivrin picked at its edges with her fingernails, keeping an eye on the people behind her. The service would start with a procession. Father Roche and his acolytes, if he had any, would come down the aisle, bearing the holy water and chanting the asperges. Kivrin pulled on the ribbon and both sides of the knot, tightening it beyond any hope of ever getting it off without cutting it, but getting a little more slack. It still wasn't enough to get the ribbon off. She glanced back at the church door. The bell had stopped, but there was still no sign of Father Roche and no aisle for him to come up either. The townsfolk had crowded in, filling the whole rear of the church. Someone had lifted a child up onto Amani's husband's tomb and was holding him there so he could see. But there wasn't anything to see yet. She went back to working on the bell. She got two fingers under the ribbon and pulled up on it, trying to stretch it. "Tear it not," Agnes said in that carrying stage whisper of hers. Kivrin took hold of the bell and hastily pulled it around so it lay in Agnes's palm. "Hold it like this," she whispered, cupping Agnes's fingers over it, tightly. Agnes obligingly clenched her little fist. Kivrin folded Agnes's other hand over the top of the fist in a so-so facsimile of a praying attitude, and said softly, "Hold tight to the bell, and it will not ring.
Agnes promptly pressed her hands to her forehead in an attitude of angelic piety.
Good girl, Kivrin said, and put her arm around her.
She glanced back at the church doors. They were still closed. She breathed a sigh of relief and turned back to face the altar. Father Roche was standing there. He was dressed in an embroidered white stole and a yellowed white alb with a hem more frayed than Agnes's ribbon, and was holding a book. He had obviously been waiting for her, had obviously stood there watching her the whole time she tended to Agnes. But there was no reproof in his face or even impatience. His face held some other expression entirely. And she was reminded suddenly of Mr. Dunworthy, standing and watching her through the thin glass partition. Lady Hermione cleared her throat, a sound that was almost a growl, and he seemed to come to himself. He handed the book to Cobb, who was wearing a grimy cassock and a pair of too large leather shoes, and knelt in front of the altar. Then he took the book back and began saying the lecterns. Kivrin said them to herself along with him, thinking the Latin and hearing the echo of the interpreter's translation.
Whom saw ye, O shepherds?
Father Roche recited in Latin, beginning the responsory.
Speak, tell us who hath appeared on the earth.
He stopped, frowning at Kivrin. He's forgotten it, she thought. She glanced anxiously at Hermione, hoping she wouldn't realize there was more to come. But Hermione had raised her head and was scowling at him, her jaw in the silk wimple clenched. Roche was still frowning at Kivrin.
Speak, what saw ye?
He said, and Kivrin gave a sigh of relief.
Tell us who hath appeared.
That wasn't right. She mouthed the next line, willing him to understand it. We saw the newborn child. He gave no indication that he had seen what she said, though he was looking straight at her.
I saw, he said, and stopped again.
We saw the newborn child,
Kivrin whispered, and could feel Lady Hermione turning to look at her.
And angels singing praise unto the Lord,
Roche said. And that wasn't right either. But Lady Hermione turned back to the front to fasten her disapproving gaze on Roche. The bishop would no doubt hear about this, and about the candles and the fraying hem, and who knew what other errors and infractions he had committed.
Speak, what saw ye?
Kivrin mouthed, and he seemed suddenly to come to himself.
Speak, what saw ye? He said clearly. And tell us of the birth of Christ. We saw the newborn child and angels singing praise unto the Lord.
He began the Confiteor Deo, and Kivrin whispered it along with him. But he got through it without any mistakes, and Kivrin began to relax a little, though she watched him closely as he moved to the altar for the Oremus Te. He was wearing a black cassock under the alb, and both of them looked like they had once been richly made. They were much too short for Roche. She could see a good 10 centimeters of his worn brown hose below the cassock's hem when he bent over the altar. The alb and cassock had probably belonged to the priest before him, or were cast-offs of Hermione's chaplain. The priest at Holy Reformed had worn a polyester alb over a brown jumper and jeans. He had assured Kivrin that the mass was completely authentic, in spite of its being held in mid-afternoon. The antiphon dated from the 8th century, he had told her, and the gruesomely detailed Stations of the Cross were exact copies of Turin's. But the church had been a converted stationer's shop, They had used a folding table for an altar, and the Carfax carillon outside had been busily destroying. It came upon the midnight clear.
Kyrie eleison, Cobb said, his hands folded in prayer.
Kyrie eleison, Father Roche said.
Christe eleison, Cobb said.
Christe eleison,
Agnes said brightly. Cliverin hushed her, her finger to her lips.
Lord have mercy, Christ have mercy, Lord have mercy.
They had used the Kyrie at the ecumenical service, probably because of some deal Holy Reform's priest had struck with the vicar in return for moving the time of the Mass, and the minister of the Church of the Millennium had refused to recite it and had looked coldly disapproving throughout, like Lady Hermione. Father Roche seemed all right now. He said the Gloria and the Gradual without faltering and began the Gospel.
In tuum sancti evangelii secundum Luci, he said,
and began to read haltingly in Latin.
Now it came to pass in those days that a decree went forth from Caesar Augustus that a census of the whole world be taken.
The vicar had read the same verses at St. Mary's. He had read it from the People's Common Bible, which had been insisted on by the Church of the Millennium, and it had begun, around then, the politicos dumped a tax hike on the ratepayers. But it was the same gospel Father Roche was laboriously reciting.
And suddenly there was with the angel a multitude of the heavenly host praising God and saying, Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace among men of good will.
Father Roche kissed the gospel.
Per evangelica dicta de leontur nostra delicta.
This ends side 2 of cassette 10 of Doomsday Book. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 11.